so that they should not appear to be introducing this innovation on their own private judgment, they persuaded the eldest of the 12 tribes to join their cause. And many of the more thoughtless people followed that tribe, supposing it capable of holding the privilege of leadership. Moses recognized that this great fortification was being built up against him, for he had chosen his brother as high priest in accordance with the oracles delivered to him. Yet there were slanders that he had falsified the oracles and made the choice out of family favoritism and affection for his brother. Reasonably distressed by all this, not only was he disbelieved even after demonstrating his own fidelity through so many proofs, but disbelieved also in matters that concern the honor of God, matters in which alone a man whose character had been falsely maligned in everything else was bound to be found truthful. For truth is the attendant of God. Moses did not think it right to teach them otherwise by mere words. Knowing that it is a hard thing to attempt to change the minds of those already gripped by opposing opinions. Instead, he beseeched God to furnish them with a visible demonstration that nothing false lay behind his choice of the priesthood. God commanded him to take 12 rods, equal in number to the tribes, and to inscribe on 11 of them the names of the other tribal leaders, and on the remaining one the name of his brother, the high priest, and then to bring them into the temple as far as the inner sanctuary. Moses did as he was commanded and waited anxiously to see what would come of it. On the next day, struck by an oracle, with the whole nation standing by, he went in and brought out the rods. All the others were unchanged, but the one on which his brother's name had been inscribed had been made a wonder. For like some noble plant, it had put forth fresh shoots, and from the abundance of its fruit hung heavy. The fruits were nuts, which have a nature opposite to that of other fruits. In most, the grape, the olive, the apple, the seed, and the edible part are distinct, and being distinct, they are also separated in place, the edible part lying outside and the seed enclosed within. But in the nut, the seed and the edible part are one and the same, both resolved into a single form, and there is one place, the interior, fortified and guarded by a double wall, one of very deep bark, the other in no way inferior to a structure of wood. By this he hints at perfect virtue. For just as in the nut the beginning and the end are the same thing, the beginning insofar as it is seed, the end insofar as it is fruit, so it is also with the virtues. Each of them happens to be both a beginning and an end. A beginning, because it grows not from some other power but from itself. An end, because it is toward this that the life lived according to nature strains. This is one explanation, but another is given, more vivid still than the first. The outer husk of the nut is bitter, and what lies within it is like a wooden wall, very hard and strong, and by both of these the fruit is shut in and is not easily seized. This he makes a symbol of the soul in training, from which he thinks it right to draw the lesson that one must first encounter toil. Toil is bitter, resistant, and hard, out of which the good is born, and for the sake of which one must not grow soft. For the one who flees toil flees also the good things, while the one who endures the hard to bear with fortitude and courage presses on toward blessedness. Virtue is not disposed to dwell among those who live delicately, whose souls have been made effeminate, and whose bodies dissolve through the unbroken indulgence of every day. When ill-treated, it departs, having first served notice of its abandonment on right reason, its ruler. But if the truth must be told, the most sacred company of prudence, self-control, courage, and justice pursues those in training, and all who, with frugality and contentment with little, emulate the austere and hard life, self-mastery and endurance, through which reasoning, the most sovereign faculty within us, is brought to unfailing health and good condition, having thrown down the heavy siege wall of the body, which drunkenness, gluttony, lechery, and the other insatiable desires have built up together, giving birth to the corpulence that stands opposed to keenness of mind. It is said, moreover, that among the trees accustomed to bud in spring, the almond both flowers first, announcing good news of a harvest of fruit, and sheds its leaves last, extending the good old age of its yearly foliage to the greatest length. Each of these facts Moses makes a symbol of the priestly tribe, hinting that it will flower both first and last of the whole human race. At whatever time it seems good to God to liken our life to the turning of spring, having done away with covetousness, that scheming source of misery. Since then, we said that four things must belong to the most perfect leader kingship. the disposition of a lawgiver, priesthood, and prophecy, so that through his lawgiving he may command what must be done and forbid what must not. Through his priesthood, he may administer not only human affairs, but divine ones as well. And through his prophecy, he may declare by oracle whatever is not grasped by reasoning. And since I have already discussed the first three and shown Moses to be the best of kings, lawgivers, and high priests, I come at last to show that he also became a prophet of the highest repute. I am not unaware that everything written in the sacred books is oracular, delivered through him, but I will speak of what is peculiarly his own, first stating this. Of the oracles, some are spoken in the person of God, through the interpretation of his divine prophet. Others were declared through question and answer. And others in the person of Moses himself, when he had become inspired and was possessed by God. The first, then, are through and through demonstrations of divine virtues, the merciful and the beneficent, through which he anoints all men toward nobility of character, and especially his own suppliant people, for whom he lays open the road leading to happiness. The second class has a mixture and a partnership, the prophet inquiring about what he seeks, and God answering and teaching. The third class is assigned to the lawgiver himself, God having imparted to him the power of foreknowledge by which he foretells what is to come. The first class, then, must be set aside, for these are too great to be praised by any human being. They could scarcely be worthily celebrated even by heaven, the cosmos, and the nature of the whole, and besides, they are spoken as though through an interpreter, and interpretation and prophecy are different things. Of the second class, I will try at once to give an account, weaving into it also the third form, in which the inspired ecstasy of the speaker is most clearly displayed, the form by which, above all and properly, one is deemed a prophet. The fulfillment of this promise must begin here. There are four instances in which the law was given by oracles through question and answer, oracles of mixed power. In one part, the prophet, in a state of inspiration, inquires. In the other, the father declares by oracle, imparting speech and answer. The first is one which provoked to anger not only Moses, the most devout man who ever lived, but even one who had tasted piety only slightly. A man of mixed descent, born of an Egyptian father and a Jewish mother, disregarded the ancestral customs of his mother's people, and inclined, it is said, toward Egyptian impiety, emulating the godlessness of that people. For the Egyptians, alone of almost all nations, have fortified earth against heaven, deeming earth worthy of honors equal to the gods, while assigning to heaven no special prerogative, as though the outlying province ought to be cared for ahead of the royal palace. For in the cosmos, heaven is the most sacred royal seat, and earth the outlying province worthy of regard in itself, but falling as short of the ether, when brought into comparison, as darkness falls short of light, night of day, corruption of incorruption, and the mortal of God. For since their land is not watered by rain as other lands are, but is accustomed every year to be flooded by the risings of the river, the Egyptians, in their account, deify the Nile as a rival image of heaven, and speak of their land in solemn terms. This man of mixed blood, then, having quarreled with one of the race gifted with vision and knowledge, and being unable to master himself through anger, and at the same time an emulator of Egyptian godlessness, extended his impiety from earth to heaven, cursing with an accursed, polluted, and defiled soul and tongue and every instrument of voice, through an excess of wickedness, him whom it is not lawful for all to bless, but only for the best, those who have received the perfect purifications. Moses, then, marveling at the man's derangement and the excess of his recklessness, though full of noble spirit and eager to put the man to death with his own hand, feared that he might thereby exact too light a punishment. For no human being could devise a penalty equal in weight to so great an impiety. And since irreverence toward God is followed also by failure to honor parents, homeland, and benefactors, what excessive depravity is left for one who, not content with irreverence, dares also to revile? And yet reviling is the lesser offense in comparison with cursing. But when loose talk and an unbridled mouth are put in the service of lawless folly, some new outrage against the sacred is always devised. O man, does anyone curse God, calling on what other God to confirm his curse? Or is it not plain that he calls on God himself, against God himself? Away with such profane and unholy thoughts. It would be well to wash clean the wretched soul that has been assailed by mere sound, using its ears as servants, with blind perception. And was the tongue of the man who uttered so great an impiety not paralyzed? Were the ears of those about to hear it not stopped up? Unless, indeed, this happened by the providence of justice, which thinks it right that neither surpassing good nor greatest evil should be kept in shadow, but brought to the clearest proof, whether of virtue or of vice, so that it may deem the one worthy of acceptance and the other of punishment. For this reason, Moses commanded that the man be led away to prison and bound, while he himself besought God, seeking to propitiate him for the compulsions of the senses, through which we see things it is not lawful to see, and hear things it is not lawful to hear, to declare what ought to befall the man who had devised so strange and outlandish an act of impiety and sacrilege. He ordered him to be stoned, a punishment fitting, I think, for a man with a stony and unyielding soul. And at the same time, he wanted everyone from the nation to have a share in the punishment, since he knew they had reacted very harshly and were murderous with rage. And it seemed that only stoning could give so many tens of thousands a part in it. After the punishment of the impious and accursed man, a new decree was written, one that had never before been thought worthy of being put in writing, but unexpected innovations call for new laws to check offenses. And so the following was at once legislated. Whoever curses God shall be guilty of sin, but whoever names the name of the Lord shall die. Lev 24:15-16. Well said, all wise one, you alone have partaken of unmixed wisdom. Did you really suppose that naming is worse than cursing? Surely you would not lighten the penalty for the man who committed the gravest impiety, treating him more leniently than those who genuinely sinned, while for the one who seemed to have done a lesser wrong you fixed the highest penalty, death. But it seems that God is here meant not of the first and uncreated God of the universe, but of the gods in the cities. And these are falsely so named, fashioned by the arts of painters and sculptors. For the inhabited world has become full of carved images and statues and fabrications of that kind, and it was necessary to restrain blasphemy against them, so that none of Moses' disciples might grow accustomed to disregarding the address to God altogether. For the title is one most worthy to be won and most worthy of love. But if anyone, I will not say blasphemes against the God of men and gods, but even dares to utter his name at an improper time, let him submit to death as his punishment. For not even those who have been begotten, mortal though they are, do people whose care is for their parents' honor speak by name. Rather, out of reverence for them, they keep silent about their given names and address them by the titles that belong to nature, calling them father and mother, by which they immediately hint at the surpassing benefits received from them and at their own grateful disposition. Shall those who thoughtlessly, by the mere sliding of the tongue, treat as filler for their speech the most holy and divine name, still be thought deserving of forgiveness? After the honor paid to the begetter of all things, the prophet also hallowed the sacred seventh day, having seen with keener eyes its extraordinary beauty, stamped upon heaven and the whole cosmos and borne along, like a statue, by nature herself. For he found it first, motherless, having no part in the female line of descent, sown by the Father alone without seed and begotten without conception. And then he perceived not only this, that it was altogether beautiful and motherless, but also that it was ever a virgin, neither born of a mother nor herself a mother, neither born of corruption nor destined for corruption. And thirdly, examining it further, he recognized it also as the birthday of the cosmos, which heaven celebrates and earth celebrates, and all things on earth that rejoice and delight in the all-harmonious seventh. For this reason, the truly great Moses judged it right that those enrolled in his sacred constitution, following the ordinances of nature, should keep festival, passing their time in cheerful good spirits, refraining in practice from the arts and occupations pursued for profit and from business dealings connected with the search for a livelihood, and observing a holiday, released from every toilsome and wearisome care, at leisure not, as some are, for laughter or games or the displays of mimes or dancers, over which theater-mad people waste away and suffer a lingering death, and by means of the poisons of the most authoritative senses, sight and hearing, enslave the soul that is by nature a queen. but at leisure for philosophy alone, not the kind that word hunters and sophists contrive, selling doctrines and arguments in the marketplace as if they were some other kind of merchandise. People who use philosophy against philosophy, O healer and son, throughout their lives without blushing. But the philosophy that is truly philosophy, which is woven together out of three things, intentions, words, and deeds, harmonized into a single form for the acquisition and enjoyment of happiness. Now someone, disregarding this decree, though he still had ringing in his ears the oracles concerning the sacred seventh day, which God had proclaimed without a prophet, through a voice, the most paradoxical thing that was visible, and which aroused the eyes of those present more than their ears, went out to gather sticks through the middle of the camp, knowing that everyone was resting quietly in their tents, and, caught in the very act of wrongdoing, was exposed so that it could not escape notice. For some people, having gone out beyond the gates into the wilderness in order to pray in the purest and quietest place, saw the lawless sight of him gathering a supply of wood, and, indignant, were on the point of killing him themselves. But restraining by reasoning the stirring of their anger, so that they might not appear to be private individuals punishing someone ahead of the rulers, and that too without trial, however evident the transgression otherwise was. Nor might they, even in the most just case, bring upon that holy day the pollution of murder. They seized him instead and brought him before the ruler, before whom the priests were sitting in council, while the whole multitude stood by to listen. For it was the custom, always as opportunity allowed, but chiefly on the seventh days, as I have shown before, to practice philosophy, with the leader expounding and teaching what ought to be done and said, while the others advanced toward nobility and were improved in both character and manner of life. From that time on, even now, the Jews philosophize on the seventh days, devoting that time to the knowledge and contemplation of the things of nature. For what else are the houses of prayer in the various cities but schools of prudence, courage, temperance, justice, piety, holiness, and every virtue, by which both human and divine matters are understood and set right? At that time, then, the man who had committed so great an impiety was led away to prison. But Moses, at a loss as to what should be done with the man, for he knew that his deeds deserved death, but what manner of punishment would be fitting, approached the invisible tribunal with his invisible soul and inquired of the judge who knew everything even before hearing it, what had been decided. And he declared his knowledge, that the man must die, and in no other way than by stoning, since in this case, as in the former one, the mind had been turned into a deaf stone by working the most complete transgression, in which nearly all the other things legislated concerning the reverence due the seventh day are included. Why is this? Because not only the vulgar crafts, but also the other arts and occupations, and especially those concerned with earning a livelihood, either involve fire or are not carried on without things that involve fire. Hence, he often forbids the kindling of fire on the seventh days, as being the most primary cause and the oldest of works, since when it rests, it was thought likely that the particular activities dependent on it would rest along with it. The material of fire is wood, so that the man who gathered wood was committing an offense akin and related to the man who kindles fire, doubling the transgression. In one respect, because though ordered to remain still, he was gathering material together, and in another, because what he was gathering together was precisely the material of fire, the origin of the arts. Both of the cases mentioned, then, involve punishments of the impious confirmed by inquiry and answer. There are two others, not of the same kind, but of a different sort, of which one concerns the succession to an inheritance, and the other concerns matters where a sacred rite appeared to be performed out of its proper time, about which I must speak first. Moses records the beginning of the vernal equinox as the first month in the cycles of the year, giving precedence not, as some do, according to mere chronological order, but according to the graces of nature, which she caused to rise for humankind. For at this time the sown crops, our necessary food, come to full growth, while the fruit of the trees, only now coming into their prime, is produced in a second rank, and is accordingly later born. For in nature, the things that are not so strictly necessary always come second to the things that are utterly necessary. Wheat and barley, then, and the other kinds of food without which it is impossible to live, are utterly necessary. But oil and wine and tree fruits are not among the necessities, since even without them, people live on to the most advanced old age, extending their lives through many years. In this month, then, around the 14th day, when the lunar cycle is about to become full, the crossing feast is celebrated, a festival open to all the people, called in Chaldean Pascha, in which it is not that private individuals bring the victims to the altar while the priests do the sacrificing, but by the ordinance of the law, the whole nation acts as priests, each person individually bringing forward and performing with his own hands the sacrifices on his own behalf. Now all the rest of the people were rejoicing and cheerful, each one considering himself honored with a priesthood. But certain others went about in tears and groaning, since relatives of theirs had recently died, and mourning them, they were held fast by a double grief, having added to the grief for their dead kin, the grief of being deprived of the pleasure and honor connected with the sacred rite. And it was not even possible for them to purify themselves and be sprinkled on that day, since the period of mourning had not yet run its course and expired. These men, after the festival, came to the ruler full of dejection and gloom, and related what had happened, the recent death of their relatives, the mourning they had been compelled to observe, and their consequent inability to take part in the sacrifice of the crossing feast. These men came to the leader after the festival, full of gloom and dejection, and told him what had happened, the recent death of their relatives, the mourning this required of them, and their consequent inability to take part in the sacrifice of the Passover. Then they asked that they not receive less than everyone else, and that their misfortune in losing family members not be reckoned as a wrongdoing that earns punishment rather than pity. They thought they would suffer worse than the dead themselves, if those who died no longer had any share in things they had not wished for, while the living, though they still had feeling, would seem to have died along with them. On hearing this, Moses saw that their plea was not unreasonable, that their excuse for not having performed the sacred rite was likewise a compelling one, and that a natural sympathy was mixed in with all this. Yet his judgment wavered, tipping first one way and then the other as on a scale. On one side, pity and justice weighed down, on the other, the law of the Passover sacrifice pressed back, which had specified both the first month and the 14th day for the rite. Carried between denial and assent, he begged God to become the judge and to reveal the decision by an oracle. And God, hearing him, pronounced an oracle not only about the matter he had been asked, but also about cases that would arise later should the same circumstances recur. And he went further still, extending his generosity even to those unable, for other reasons, to perform the sacrifice with the whole nation, and gave a further oracle about them. What then were the oracles given about these people must be told. Mourning for kin, he said, is a necessary grief for blood relations, and it is not written down among offenses. So then, as long as it remains within the appointed time, let the mourner be kept outside the sacred precincts, which must be kept pure from every pollution, not only the involuntary kind, but also that which is not deliberate. But once the appointed time has passed, let them not be deprived of equal participation in the sacred rites, so that the living are not treated as mere appendages of the dead. Let them go as being second, in the second month, again on the 14th day, and let them sacrifice according to the same rules as the first group, and use the victim as they did, by the same law and in like manner. The same provision is granted also to those kept, not by mourning, but by a long journey abroad, from joining in the sacrifice with the whole nation together. For those living abroad or dwelling elsewhere do no wrong such that they should be deprived of equal honor, especially since the nation, because of its great numbers, could not be contained within a single land, but has sent out colonies in every direction. Having said this much about those who, through unwanted circumstances, were late in offering the Passover sacrifice with the multitude but were eager, even though late, to make up of necessity what had been lacking, I now turn to the last enactment, concerning the succession of inheritances, which likewise arose in mixed fashion, from a question and an answer. There was a man named Zelophehad, a man of standing and of no undistinguished tribe. To him were born 5 daughters but no son. After their father's death, suspecting they would be deprived of their father's portion because inheritances were given to males, they approached the leader with the modesty befitting young women, not in pursuit of wealth, but eager to preserve their father's name and standing, and said, "Our father has died, and he died having taken part in none of the rebellions in which thousands perished, but pursued a peaceable, private life, unless indeed it should be counted a fault that he lacked male offspring. We stand here seemingly orphans, but in truth we shall have you as a father, for the lawful ruler is closer kin to his subjects than the one who begot them." Moses, admiring the good sense of the young women and their devotion to the one who had begotten them, was nonetheless held back, drawn by another consideration: that inheritances were owed to men who were to receive them as a reward for the campaigns and wars they had endured, whereas nature, by exempting women from such struggles, plainly withholds from them also a share in the prizes set for them. So it was reasonable that, his mind being pulled both ways and torn between opposing claims, he referred the perplexity to God, whom alone he knew to distinguish even the smallest differences by criteria that never lie and never err, in order to display truth and justice. But the Maker of all things, the Father of the universe, who holds together and governs earth and heaven, water and air, and all that is composed of each of these, the ruler of gods and men, did not disdain to give an oracle to orphaned girls. And in giving it, he granted something even greater than a judge would. Being gracious and merciful, he who has filled all things through all things with his beneficent power delivered a eulogy of the young women. "O Master, how could anyone hymn you with what mouth, what tongue, what instrument of voice, what governing faculty of the soul? Could the stars, joined into a single choir, sing any song worthy of you? Could the whole heaven, dissolved into a single voice, be able to recount any part of your virtues? Rightly," he says, "have the daughters of Zelophehad spoken. How great a eulogy this is, coming from the testimony of God, who does not know. Come forward now, you boasters, you who breathe great things over your own good fortune, who raise your necks beyond what nature allows and arch your eyebrows, you among whom the widowhood of women is mocked as laughable, a pitiable evil, and the desolation of orphaned children is jeered at as more pitiable still. And seeing that those who seem so lowly and unfortunate are not classed by God among the despised and obscure, he whose most dishonored possession is the kingdom scattered everywhere across the inhabited world, since the whole circuit of the earth is but the furthest edge of his works, receive this necessary admonition." Yet though he praised the petition of the young women, he neither left them without reward nor brought them to equal honor with the men who had fought. Rather, to the men he assigned the inheritances as prizes proper to their own valorous deeds, while to the women he granted them as a matter of grace and kindness, not as a reward, which he makes perfectly clear through the words, "gift, and you shall give," Num 27:7, and not "repayment, or you shall repay." For the latter belong properly to those who receive what is owed, the former to those who bestow a favor. Having given his oracle concerning what the orphaned young women had petitioned, he also lays down a more general law about the succession of inheritances. First, sons are called to share the father's goods. If there are no sons, then daughters come second, and to them, he says, the inheritance must be attached as an outward adornment, not as an inherited possession belonging to them by nature. For what is merely attached has no intrinsic kinship with what it adorns, being foreign to its harmony and unity. After daughters, he calls brothers third, and assigns fourth rank to paternal uncles, hinting thereby that fathers too could become heirs of their sons. For it would be quite foolish to suppose that, in assigning an inheritance to a father's brother on account of his kinship with the father, he thereby excluded the father himself from succession. But since it is the law of nature for parents to be inherited by their children, and not for parents to inherit from them, he passed over in silence that which is unwished for and ill-omened, so that father and mother should not seem to be profiting from the inconsolable grief over children who died before their time. Instead, he called upon them obliquely, by naming the uncles, so as to aim at both what is fitting and at preventing the estate from passing to strangers. After the uncles comes the fifth rank, the nearest relatives, to whom he always gives the inheritance if none of those before them remain. Having necessarily gone through these oracles concerning inheritances of a mixed character, I will next set forth the oracles pronounced through the prophet's inspiration alone, for this is what I promise to show. The beginning, then, of his divinely possessed rapture is also the beginning of the nation's good fortune, when it set out from Egypt for the cities of Syria in a migration of many tens of thousands. For men and women together, having crossed a vast, untrodden wilderness, arrived at the sea called the Red Sea. Then, as was likely, they found themselves at a loss, unable to cross for want of boats, and not considering it safe to turn back the same way. While they were in this state, a still greater evil fell upon them. The king of the Egyptians, having taken a considerable force, both cavalry and infantry, set out in pursuit, hastening to overtake them, so as to punish them for the departure he had permitted them to make under clear divine warnings. But as it seems, the disposition of wicked men is unstable, swaying to opposite extremes on the slightest pretext, as on a small scale. Caught between enemies and the sea, they despaired of their own safety. Some thought the most pitiable destruction a thing to be wished for. Others resolved it would be better to throw themselves into the sea, and, loading themselves with something heavy, waited at the shore so that, when they saw the enemy drawing near, they might leap down and be more easily carried into the depths. But while they were terrified at the helplessness of their plight, dying a thousand deaths, the prophet, seeing in his amazement the whole nation caught as in a fisherman's net, was no longer himself. He became possessed by God and uttered these oracles. Fear is inevitable, the danger near and great. Before us lies a gaping sea, no refuge to flee to, no boats to be had. Behind us press the ranks of the enemy, advancing without pause in pursuit. Which way can one turn, which way escape? Everything, from every side, has suddenly assailed us, earth, sea, men, the elements of nature. But take courage, do not despair. Stand firm in your minds and do not waver, expect the invincible help that comes from God. It will arrive of its own accord, and unseen it will fight for you before you even engage. You have already experienced it many times, defending you invisibly. I see it now, already raising dust, throwing nooses around the necks of your adversaries. It is dragging them down into the sea. Like lead, they are sinking to the depths. You perceive them still living, but I already have a vision of them as dead men. And today you too will see them as corpses. So he uttered these words, greater than any hope could conceive, and the people found by experience the truth of that oracle. For what came to pass through divine power turned out to be more incredible than any fable. The splitting of the sea, the withdrawal of each of its two divided masses, the congealing of the waves along the whole depth of the breach on either side, so as to form walls of the greatest strength, and the straight-cut incision of the road wrought so mightily, which ran between the frozen walls. The nation's journey, walking through the sea on foot without danger, as on a dry path and a rocky floor, for the sand had been dried hard, and its scattered substance fused into one, the enemy's headlong pursuit without pause. As they rushed to their own destruction, the guidance of the cloud bringing up the rear, in which there was a certain divine sight, a flash of fire gleaming out, the returning surge of the waters that had until then stood apart, held back, the sudden reflooding of the section that had been split open and dried, the enemy's destruction, whom the frozen walls, now overturned, lulled to their end, and the floodwaters of the sea, sweeping down upon the road as into a ravine, engulfed. The display of their destruction through the bodies that floated to the surface and covered the face of the sea, and the violent surging of the waves, by which all the corpses were cast up in heaps onto the shores opposite, providing a spectacle that those who had been saved needed to see. For it fell to them not only to escape the dangers, but also to look upon their enemies punished, beyond all telling, by powers not human but divine. For this reason, he rightly honors his benefactor with hymns of thanksgiving. Dividing the nation into two choirs, one of men and one of women, he himself leads the men, and he appoints his sister to lead the women as well, so that they might sing hymns to their father and maker, sounding together in responsive harmonies, through a blending of both character and melody. The two choirs pursuing the same refrain in turn, the harmony being built on the concord of low pitch with high. For the voices of the men are deep, and those of the women are high, and when their blending is proportioned rightly, the result is a melody most sweet and wholly harmonious. And he persuaded so many tens of thousands to think as one and to join together in singing the same hymn about those astonishing, mighty works which I recounted a little earlier. At this the prophet rejoiced, and seeing the nation's own great joy, no longer able to contain his own delight, he let off the song, and those who heard it gathered into two choirs, sang back what he had sung. This is the beginning and prelude of the prophecy of Moses that came by inspired possession. Next, he prophesies about the first and most necessary thing, food, which the earth did not bear, for it was barren and unfruitful, but heaven rained down, not once, but every day for 40 years before dawn, an ethereal fruit in the dew, resembling millet. Seeing this, Moses commands them to gather it, and moved by inspiration, declares, "Those who have experienced God's beneficence in matters beyond all hope must trust him. Let there be no storing, no hoarding of this food. Let no one leave over any part of it until morning." Hearing this, some of those with no ballast of piety, supposing perhaps that what was said was not an oracle but merely a ruler's advice, left some of it over until the next day. But what putrefied filled the circuit of the camp first with a foul stench, then turned into worms, whose generation comes from decay. Seeing this, Moses was naturally embittered against the disobedient. For how could he not be? After witnessing such great and manifold things, things impossible to accomplish by any plausible or reasonable expectation, yet brought to completion with ease by divine forethought, how could the most obtuse of all men not merely hesitate but actually disbelieve? But the Father established the prophet's oracle by two most evident proofs, of which he immediately displayed the first through the decay and foul smell of what was left over and its transformation into worms, the most contemptible of creatures. The second he displayed later, for whatever surplus remained from what had been gathered in whatever abundance was always dissolved by the sun's rays and melting, wasted away entirely. Second, not long after, moved by inspiration, he pronounced an oracle concerning the sacred seventh day. For humankind had been ignorant that this day possessed a privilege in nature, not merely from the time the world was fashioned, but even before the coming to be of heaven and every object of sense perception, perhaps because of the continuous and successive destructions that occurred by water and by fire, which prevented earlier generations from handing down to later ones the memory of the sequence and order that unfolds through the ages. What was thus hidden he revealed, moved by inspiration, in an oracle attested by a clear sign. The sign was this: the food that came down from the air was less abundant on the earlier days, but on that day it was double, and whatever remained over from the earlier days would melt away, dissolving until it was entirely wasted away into moisture. But on that day, admitting of no such change, it stayed the same. Struck by these things, both announced and seen, Moses did not merely conjecture, but, carried by God, pronounced the sanctity of the seventh day. I need not say that such inferences too are akin to prophecy, for the mind could not have hit its mark so unerringly had there not also been a divine spirit guiding it toward the truth itself. The marvel was made plain not only by the doubling of the food, nor merely by its remaining uncorrupted contrary to established practice, but also by the fact that both these things occurred on the sixth day, from which the food began to be supplied from the air, after which the seventh day, most sacred of numbers, was about to rise. So that one who reasons rightly would find that the heavenly food given corresponds to the order of the world's own creation. For he began to fashion the world too on the first day of the six, and to rain down the food I have mentioned. The image is most exact. Just as he brought forth out of not being into being the most perfect work, the world, so in the same manner he transformed the elements to meet the pressing need, providing abundance in the wilderness, so that instead of the earth, the air might bring nourishment without labor and without toil, for those who had no way to withdraw and prepare provisions at their leisure. After this, he utters, third, a most portentous oracle, declaring that on the seventh day the air will not furnish its accustomed food, and that nothing, not even the smallest amount, will be brought down to earth as usual. This was confirmed by what actually happened. For on the day before he had proclaimed this, yet some of unsteady character set out to gather food, and, disappointed in their hope, returned empty-handed, reproaching themselves for their lack of faith and calling the prophet a true seer, one who speaks the word of God and alone foresees what is hidden. Such, then, are the things he prophesied, possessed by God, concerning the heavenly food. Next come other necessary things, which might seem to resemble exhortations more than oracles. Among them is what was declared during the greatest defection from ancestral ways of which I spoke earlier, when they fashioned a golden bull, an imitation of Egyptian arrogance, and set up choruses and built altars and offered sacrifices, forgetting the true God and casting down the nobility of their ancestors, which had been built up through piety and holiness. At this, Moses was overwhelmed with grief. First, that the whole people had suddenly become blind, they who until just before had been the keenest sighted of all nations. And second, that a fabricated false invention had had the power to extinguish so great a light of truth, a light which neither the eclipsing of the sun nor the whole chorus of stars could ever overshadow. For it is illumined by its own light, intelligible and incorporeal, in comparison with which the light perceived by the senses might be reckoned as night compared to day. And for this reason, no longer remaining the same man, he was transformed in both appearance and thought, and, moved by inspiration, he declared, "Who is he who has not been swept along by the error, nor ascribed authority to what has none? Let every such person come to me." When one tribe came forward, no less in mind than in body, men who had long burned with hatred against the godless and unholy, and who sought to find a leader and commander who would justly show them the occasion and manner of vengeance. Finding them eager and full of daring and resolve, he, carried by God even more than before, said, "Let each of you take up his sword and rush through the whole camp, and let him kill not only strangers, but also his nearest and dearest among friends and kin, one after another, judging this deed most righteous, done on behalf of truth and the honor of God, for whom to fight and to strive is the lightest of labors." And they, killing on the spot 3,000 men, who had been the chief instigators of the impiety, not only cleared themselves of any complicity in that outrage, but were also enrolled among the noblest of the brave, and were deemed worthy of the prize most fitting to their deeds, the priesthood. For it was right that those who had shown valor and fought in the front rank on behalf of holiness should become its ministers. I have another oracle to disclose, more significant still, which I also related earlier when I was recounting the matters of the prophet's high priesthood, one which he himself, again possessed, uttered, and which was fulfilled not long afterward, but immediately at the very moment it was prophesied. Among those who minister about the temple there are two ranks, the higher, that of priests, the lesser, that of temple attendants. At that time there were three priests, but many thousands of temple attendants. These men, puffed up by the superior number of their own following, held the priests' small numbers in contempt, and wove together two crimes at once. The pulling down of their betters and the raising up of their inferiors, the sort of thing that happens when subjects set themselves against their leaders, to the ruin of that order which is best and most useful to the people. Then they gathered together and formed a faction, and shouted against the prophet, claiming that out of favoritism toward his brother and his nephews he had granted them the priesthood, and had lied about their being chosen by divine appointment, as we have already related events that never happened. Distressed and deeply pained by this, though he was the gentlest and mildest of men, he was so sharpened toward righteous anger by a passion that hates wickedness that he begged God to turn away from their sacrifice, not because the most just judge was ever going to accept the sacred rites of impious men, but because the soul of one beloved of God does not, for its own part, stay silent, but presses eagerly that unholy men should not prosper, but should always fail of their purpose. Still boiling and inflamed with righteous indignation, he fell into inspiration, was changed into a prophet, and pronounced this oracle. "A hard thing is unbelief, but only for the unbelieving. These men are schooled not by argument but by deeds. Once they have suffered, they will know that my word is not false, since though they were taught, they did not understand. This will be decided by the end of their lives. For if they meet the death that is according to nature, then my oracles are fabrications. But if some strange and altered death, then my love of truth will stand as my witness. I see chasms of earth opening and widening to their utmost extent, populous clans perishing, whole households with all their people being swept down and swallowed up, living men descending into Hades." When he had fallen silent, the earth was shaken by an earthquake and split open, and it split open precisely where the tents of the impious stood, so that they were carried down altogether and hidden from sight. For the parted portions of earth came together again once the purpose for which they had been divided was accomplished. A little later, Thunderbolts fell suddenly upon the leaders of the faction, 250 men, and consumed them all together, leaving behind no part of their bodies to receive burial. The succession of these punishments, one upon another, and the magnitude of each, made clear and famous the piety of the prophet, who had made God his witness to the truth of his oracles. It is worth not passing over this too, that earth and heaven, the first principles of the universe, divided between themselves by lot the punishments against the impious. For these men had rooted their wickedness in the earth, but had stretched it up into the upper air, raising it to so great a height. Hence each of the elements supplied its own punishment. The earth, splitting apart and gaping open, so as to drag down and swallow those who at that time were weighing upon her. And heaven, so as to burn up and destroy them, pouring down a most strange rain, a downpour of abundant fire. And the end was the same both for those who were swallowed up and for those destroyed by the thunderbolts. Neither group was ever seen again. The former were hidden within the earth, when the chasm's parted sides came together and were made level once more. The latter were consumed entirely, through and through, by the fire of the thunderbolt. Some time later, when he was about to make his migration from here to heaven, and leaving behind his mortal life, to be made immortal at the summons of the Father, who transformed him, a duality of body and soul, wholly and entirely into the nature of a single unity, remolding him into a mind like the sun in its brightness, then, possessed by God, he no longer appeared to prophesy collectively to the whole nation gathered together, but to each tribe separately, concerning what would happen to it and what its outcome would be. Some of these things have already come to pass, and others are still awaited, since the fulfillment of what has already happened is the guarantee of what is still to come. For it was fitting, since the tribes differed even in their manner of birth, especially in their maternal lines and in the manifold forms of their councils, and in the untold differences of their pursuits in life, that they should also obtain, as if by a kind of lot, an apportionment of oracles and prophecies suited to each. These things, then, are marvelous. But most marvelous of all is the end of the sacred writings, which, like the head in a living creature, stands at the summit of the whole legislation. For already being taken up, and standing at the very starting line from which he was to take his winged course to heaven, inspired and possessed by God, while still alive he prophesies concerning himself as though already dead, with unerring accuracy. How he died without yet having died. How he was buried with no one present clearly by hands not mortal but immortal. How he was not laid to rest in the tomb of his forefathers, but obtained a tomb all his own, which no human being has ever seen. How the whole nation mourned him, weeping for an entire month, displaying a grief both private and public, because of the ineffable goodwill and care he had shown to each one and to all together. Such was his life, and such also was the end of Moses, king and lawgiver and high priest and prophet, as it is recorded in the sacred writings.